Thank you. Good. Well, let's hope for the best. Gabby Woods, let's talk to you about your book, Living Dolls, which is about automatons, robots, androids, and so on through history. You deal with lots of examples in this book. What's your favourite one?
I think probably an early one. There was a duck, a mechanical duck that was made in the 18th century that could eat and also then excrete its food. And it was digest it, supposedly. And then excrete it as a sort of green mush at the other end.
How amazing. How did it do it?
Well, I mean, much later on, when people repaired it, because this duck outlived its maker, there were people who saw its insides and thought that it was a fake, that it actually never digested it. And there were two compartments, one which would sort of hoover the food up.
It was a fake.
And another one that would sort of, you know, push out this sort of green mush. But I mean, what amazed me about it was that it was exhibited, you know, Louis the 15th saw it. It was covered in gold and it was very beautiful. So there was a mixture of this very sort of glitzy stuff.
Was it Voltaire who called it the glory of France?
Absolutely.
It was being sarcastic, you
know. Well, who knows?
I mean, you deal with all sorts of examples in this book. I mean, an artificial flute player or attempts to create a humanoid which would bleed. You claim that these were more than mere curiosities, that they somehow embodied ideas about what it meant to be human. Did it ever occur to you while writing this book that perhaps you were taking them a little too seriously and these were in fact just toys?
Absolutely. I'm sure many people didn't take them that seriously. I think there is a sense in which they represented something just because of the ideas of the time, particularly those in the 18th century. I mean, if Voltaire, even if he is being sarcastic, if Voltaire can comment on these things, he's still seen them. I mean, they may be toys, but they're also representative of certain ideas. The machine that could bleed.
What's this? What ideas?
Well, ideas about, I mean, digestion, for example.
Produce a magazine, a toy that can artificially crap. I mean, how is that?
It's a joke, but it's a joke possibly at the expense of all the philosophers who were debating how digestion was done. I mean, people didn't know at the time.
Some of them, is it Descartes you cite the example of, who lost a child and took an artificial human with him?
Yeah.
Tell us just that story.
Well, he did lose a child. He lost a daughter whose name was Francine, and she was 5 when she died of scarlet fever. And a few years later, this is completely unverifiable, this story, but it's been told a number of times about him. He went on a trip to Sweden, his last trip, and he took somebody he called his daughter with him. He said he was travelling with his daughter Francine, and this daughter turned out to be a machine that he'd made, an android, in the shape of a child. And the sailors who were going with him to Sweden were so frightened of this thing that they threw it overboard.
You can see why that would be disturbing. It's, I think, disturbing for all of us. Anyone who's had children or had anything to do with children would find that idea slightly alarming. But many of them were actually just tricks, weren't they? I mean, the Turkish chess player, for example, which is said to have defeated Napoleon and gloriously Catherine the Great's disqualified for cheating against this machine. That was a trick, I take it.
That was a trick. But again, you know, it did overlap with ideas about whether machines could think. I mean, it was a joke that was supposed to draw out all sorts of philosophical problems, I think. I mean,
why did people not figure out that there was a man inside that machine?
Well, it is amazing, isn't it? Because it must have been quite easy.
How can you fool all the people all the time? Especially chess, you know, because it's a very unique personal thing. How is it? Did people really fall for it? Do you believe they did?
I'm not sure they did all fall for it. I think they probably wanted to fall for it, and so they didn't look too hard.
You talk quite a lot, though, about this sort of fear. I mean, you use the word fear, but you also use the word uncanny that sort of runs through. And in a way, isn't that precisely because what's happening is that the boundary between the soul or the mind and the body is being encountered through this? But why, I mean, since so much of this was about a sort of physical process of replication, why did we get into the sort of psychology of it? What are the issues there?
Why do people at the time?
Why do people fear?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think a lot of it is to do with religion. I mean, particularly the chess player, people who saw that in the latter half of the 18th century did cross themselves. Some people fainted when they saw it. A great chess player, Philidor, who played against it, said that it was the hardest match of his life because he didn't know what forces were operating it. I think that's the fear. I mean, it's right. I mean, you're right. You are talking about a physical object, a box with a man inside and a wooden man on top, you know, but... But it's just very strange. If you can't see the man inside, there's something spooky about it.
But what would have induced such a brilliant chess player to spend his life inside a box pretending to be a mechanical chess player?
It's very interesting, isn't it? Why would he do it?
Yeah, because he's so small.
Well, because he says there were many chess.
There were many chess players, right? They were recruited, and they all kept the secret. I don't get it. I mean, it was a great scam that went on for a long time.
It was a great scam. I think, I mean, my only supposition about it, really, is that it's very like playing blindfold chess, that people who are great chess players like to play blind, because it's sort of super chess, in a way. And that playing inside the box, which had all sorts of discomforts, I mean, you had to sort of scrunch up, and there were candles, and if the candle went out, you had to make a noise to pretend the machine wasn't working, and then get another candle. I mean, all sorts of complicated things. But presumably, it is virtuoso chess.
I was interested about what you had to say about why some of these automata were women. Is implicit in that, given that their designers were officially male, the idea that the only way you could have the perfect woman was to manufacture her?
I mean, that comes up quite a bit in fiction, doesn't it? I mean, Hoffman's story, The Sandman, where the man falls in love with a doll, not knowing it's a doll, but in fact thinking it must be the perfect woman. I think there is an element of that. I mean, they weren't all women, but the ones who were, that, I mean, I, as a woman, find it very sort of unsettling to read these true stories, because I think, well, you know, why would you want to manufacture this? What's wrong with real women? And there is a sort of, there is a novel I focus on which has sort of reflections in a true story about Thomas Edison, which was to do with a man who fell in love with this woman the way she looked, but as soon as she opened her mouth, he couldn't stand it anymore, and so he asked Edison to manufacture a woman who was perfect in every way.
What do you make of that, Fiona Reynolds?
Well, I think it's that says all kinds of messages about people's attitudes to different groups, and maybe the gender thing is I think runs through lots of other parts of our society.
That would be so much simpler, though, wouldn't it? I mean, you can manufacture perfect men as well.
Yeah, because if we then imbue these models with psychological attributes and, you know, find them spooky because we can't quite understand that they are simply physical. I mean, in a sense, we recreate the complexity of our own world, which is ultimately a sort of cultural perspective.
Absolutely. It's all projection, yeah.
So, in a way, we can't escape our own destiny, which, whether it's one of extinction or whether it's more optimistic than that, actually is one where we live in a deeply cultural society where science helps us but doesn't provide all the answers, and I think we're hearing that message very much through these automata as well.
This is actually slightly outside the terms of your book, but from what you know and from what you've studied, we're not necessarily that far away from computers, robots which have the capacity to think. What does that do to our idea of cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am?
Well, I think you have to change that. I think you have to change the boundaries of it. Because I think that's exactly the problem. I think that's where the fear lies. You know, if you can replicate a human being, then what's left for us? You know, what is there that we can do on our own? And I mean, it doesn't mean that we don't exist just because we can make machines that can think. So I think you have to sort of redress that somehow.
Okay, well, thank you all very much. You can learn more about Gabby Wood's ideas in her book, Living Dolls. It's out now. Fiona Reynolds' lecture, The Future of the